Right, well, we can either do a loop of here, or we can go right and then up the river a bit.
I don't mind. I'm curious what's down there.
Let's do a loop up here.
Yeah, I'm curious.
Right. So, ladies and gents, welcome back to a retro ramble, one of our bonus episodes. I haven't done one in quite a while. I actually have a guest, and it's not Rob for once, which is highly embarrassing. Say hello, Mr. Biffo.
Hello, everybody.
Now, those of you who don't know Mr. Biffo is Paul Rose, teletext fame, digitizer fame, found footage fame, huge amounts of just everything there, actually. You've got stuff. It goes from very surreal comedy through to your kind of your YouTube success recently, I guess we could say.
Because I wouldn't go as far as success, but it's definitely starting to grow for the first time in about 5 years.
But it's so the people that may have known you like 2 or 3 years ago, or even further back, will know things like your teletext humour and your previous YouTube kind of escapades, like found footage, for example. It's a niche, I would say, and it's you're either going to enjoy it or you're not. And
I mean, Marmite, I think,
100%
visual Marmite.
I mean, the fact that you've got the anecdote to say the Ginger Wildheart of the Wildheart fame contact you, saying,
so
"Can
bizarre.
You film my tour?"
I mean, the thing is, I when that happened, because he loved found footage. I mean, I've got a mate who is like a massive Wild Hearts fan, and I didn't know their stuff. I just, you know, and telling my mate, I mean, suffice to say. Because he wanted me to go on tour with them. genuinely, bloody Wild Hearts. I mean, I knew their reputation, if not their music.
Well, that's it. One of the stories, or one of the most popular stories, is that back in his heyday of drugs and alcohol, he was invited to Kerrang! And he tore the office up.
Jeez, yeah.
And he was kicked out, and that was that. So... possibly you made a right choice to not agreeing to
I mean,
that
I kind
one.
Of, in the end, I turned it down because, I mean, suffice to say, I didn't really want to be up away from home for 3 months filming a rock band. But it was more, I just didn't feel I had the correct skills at that time. I didn't feel like I knew what I was doing enough. But
well, I do worry as well, and we'll get onto the retro rambling bit in a moment. I do what. So Ginger Wilder, I never realised this until I followed him on X, Twitter, whatever you want to call it, the depths of hell now. He's an incredible artist.
Right, I
so
didn't know that.
A vast majority of the album art or art that you see that he puts up is he's done. So I would worry, would his creative influence be expected of you? So you would have your ideals, what you would expect within found footage. Would he try and push some of his...
Well, the brief was that he gave me was make it like found footage. And he said, I want it to be really fucked up. That was what he said to me, you know, make it really just the same like style, make it really mad and weird. And, you know, and I just thought, yes, but how do I do that within on a Wild Hearts tour? How do I capture that as well? I just didn't feel I had the skills, suffice to say.
That's fair enough. But Eric, ignoring those sort of anecdotes, let's move on to what we're really here for, which is a vague retro gaming bonus episode of the podcast. I've got 6 questions. They're mostly generic, but there's a couple in there that aren't so generic. But the first question is horribly generic, so I apologise to everyone on that one. But that is your genuine first gaming memory. So that's not necessarily the first game you played, but maybe the first game you ever saw that led you into wanting to look at games.
Wow, that's hard because I'm incredibly old. The first one that comes to mind, and I must have been aware of games prior to this, was I found, and I still to this day don't know. Oh, God, the midges!
Oh,
here.
The midges insanity. Are ridiculous. But there's a quite nice cafe, and it's open.
Oh God, look what it's called!
Yeah. Oh, dear.
Tasty Bean Cafe.
Shall we cut right here and then we can follow it across? But
So I must have been aware of games because I was excited when I found this thing in the cupboard. And it was like a little kind of, you know, plug-in black and white games console.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Boxed up. And I assumed it was my Christmas present.
Oh, right, okay.
And I never saw it again. It was like, and to this, I've asked my mum about it, and she has no memory of this thing. I don't know what it was doing in there. It was brand new.
How bizarre.
You know, and it was a small one. We eventually got a Binatone.
I was going to say, so it would have been of that era. So that, yeah. you're looking at your TV games era,
that's
aren't you? So your Pong
am.
Or... Yeah. Us British people changed it to tennis for some reason. Why you couldn't just keep the name that everyone else abused.
I know. But it was a small one. It wasn't the size of a Binotone. It was in a little box. I remember that.
Okay.
But, I mean, prior to that, I mean, it was... It, yeah, prior to that, I don't know what I would have seen. I mean, I've got some... I've got memories of doing a day trip to Calais and going to an arcade there. While my parents were having their lunch, it was like, oh, can I go to the arcade, get some money for the arcade next door. but actually playing a game for the first time, I don't know.
That's the point. So actually I'm much more preferred the answer that you've given anyway, because that is your first gaming memory, is of this weird console that you'd not seen before. Where did it come from?
And what
did it do?
Yeah.
So often people will say that their first gaming memory, and they'll pick out such a standard game. So if someone says to me, it's almost always going to be based on the ZX Spectrum, because that's what I grew up
with. Yeah,
yeah. That's the first thing I remember, and it's either Jet Set Willy or Operation Wolf. Everyone hears that, so it's like,
yeah, yeah.
To hear something different is nice, because it does change it up somewhat.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's you know, I remember the day I got my Spectrum, Christmas morning, probably 1980. Yeah, I can remember that.
Oh,
very
well, so you weren't even a 48K, you were the...
That was 16K,
the 16K
ended up getting the expansion pack.
Oh.
Bought an expansion pack with, was it Crazy Kong? Ocean's Kong ripoff. You know, and I'd convince my dad we need the expansion pack, because he was, you know, he was quite excited by technology, so you know, he was quite an easy one to win over.
That's a nice little touch. I still don't, and I've asked my mum and my dad before, I've got no idea. We ended up with the 48K Spectrum. And it wasn't the rubber-keyed version. It was I think it was the ZX Spectrum Plus, which was the 48K in the kind of toast rack body.
Yeah. Well, I eventually upgraded to that.
And it turned up in, I think, something like 88 or 89's Christmas. And we still don't know what... It was a family present. But my family's scared of technology.
Right.
We didn't have a CD player until I was at secondary school, and I was bought one as a birthday present. So why they chose to just... put money into that all of a sudden, I've got no idea.
So you could do your homework, Tom. That's what they were for, remember?
Well, no, because we'd got all the games included with it.
Right, was it one of those packs?
No, my uncle and aunt had bought my cousins a Speccy a year before.
Right.
And they just sent over a giant box of all the cassettes copied.
Oh, right.
So okay. I think the vast majority of our collection was pirate.
Yeah. I mean, I was weird when it came to pirated games. I was... I don't want to make myself sound like some pious twat, but I always like having a real game with the art and the packaging. And yet, you know, I did have some pirate games because mates would just give them to me. But I just enjoyed that whole thing of getting a new game. Looking at it on the bus home and
reading the manual, seeing any screenshots that there might be, and then just knowing what's coming up based on what you read, is it's a completely different world now. And if Rob was here, he'd be absolutely singing quite loudly about how he hates digital only gaming now.
Yeah.
As it's trash. You don't own anything, and there's nothing to hold, and even if you do buy a new game now, there's no manual.
Although, of course, the downside of that is when you do put a disc in, is the updates that you have to go through anyway. And it's like, I hadn't played on my PS5 for a while. I bought, for my sins, Star Wars Outlaws. I think, okay, I'm going to play this today. Right, it's just turned up, and then like 3 hours later, I'm still not able to play the bloody thing.
That's another thing. Day one gaming back in the day of the Speccy was the cassette.
Yeah.
You might have been really unlucky and there might have been a bad batch released, but that was it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, well, the next question you've already possibly
answered. Oh, no, this is what happens with me. I ramble.
Join the club, which is why I've called it the Retro Rambles. It's the first console you were bought or you bought.
I have a different answer for that.
Go on then.
First console, obviously, Binotone, but we also had an Atari VCS.
Crikey,
the Binotone
okay.
was the family one. I think the VCS was kind of mine, although it did sit in the living room.
But was that the only TV?
That's a good question. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, it was before our TV.
Crossover over here.
But the first one I ever bought with my own money was a Master System. My first paycheck for my first job, working for Ladbrokes Racing.
I was just going to say, that's Ladbrokes, if I remember the history.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it was a Master System. And, you know, with Alex Kidd, I think, came with it in Miracle World.
Yeah. Was that the one that was built into the console, or was it the one that came with the...
No.
I don't know, because they weren't doing packing games like that.
I think it came on a card.
Okay.
Because they did, if anyone remembers, Master System games didn't just come on cartridge.
No, they came on the... Well, it's not a smart card, but it looked like a credit card with a giant SIM chip on it.
Yeah, yeah. And I've got a feeling it was that. I may be wrong, but I think it was.
Oh, no, it's... I loved the Master System, but I never really got much of a chance to play it. It was one of these ones that a couple of my friends had, but obviously I was still...
Which way do you want to go? Left, right?
Oh, we'll go right, shall we? I was enamoured with my Speccy and nothing could beat that. And then obviously by the time that I realised other things existed, the Mega Drive was there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's weird because I was very fond of my Mega Drive. I don't have the same fondness for the Master System, though. I probably had it, 2 years before I got a Mega Drive. I had a lot of games for it. Spy versus Spy, that was a good one.
Again, had the version of the Speccy, which is probably nowhere near the Master System version.
Yeah.
Of love for Spy versus Spy, actually. It doesn't get that many mentions when you talk about games of that era.
Yeah.
Especially on the multiplayer side of it.
Yeah, it was great for multiplayer. Quietly kind of, doing its own thing. It wasn't like anything else, really. So the Master System was the first one I bought. And even though, I mean, Christ, do you remember as well? The Master System the joypads used to come with this little nub that you could screw in.
The nub, you could turn it into a joystick.
Yeah, kind of.
It never worked very well.
No.
But I don't think any of my mates managed to ever... keep one of the joysticks anyway. They were gone.
Right. Yeah. And then there was that massive one as well that you could get, the stick thing that was like, it was like probably the chunkiest joystick that was ever released for any system.
There's the Master System's equivalent of the arcade stick, I'm guessing, wasn't it? It was a proper arcade buttons on it as well. And then.
But this huge kind of massive gear stick style knob that.
But that era of accessories as well, because any of the kind of generation now don't even really feel the pain that people of the 90s generation felt with third-party PlayStation controllers.
Yeah.
The fact that you could go into Game or wherever in that time and you could buy a £4.99 controller, it was dog shit, but you could buy it. It was Mad Cats, probably.
Yeah.
But even that's really gone now. I don't think I've ever played... recently a third party controller that's been a bit pony.
Wow, I'm trying to think what the do you know what, I did actually buy some Wii accessories, for Wii Sports, like a kind of fake crap tennis racket. I did buy a pack, and it was a really cheap pack, like $9.99. you got like about five different things, like a golf club,
tennis racket, crossbow crap thing.
So it was, and I liked it because it sort of took me back to those days of having kind of crap accessories that you might use once.
Yeah, I think the one I remember, I bought a NES at a car boot sale, depending on what you remember of St Albans, there was a little shopping precinct in there called the Maltings.
Right.
And it had somewhere called the Inn Shops.
Oh, yeah.
And when you went into the Inn Shops up the top, there was this little electronic shop. It sold... the very typical nice shop of like alarm clocks, kettles, things like that. Just a real hodgepodge of kind of electrical items in it for sale. And it had this quick shot flight controller.
Right.
And it just looked like this flight yoke, and it had a level in the middle that went up and down if you wanted to.
Nice.
And it's just like, well, I don't really need it, but I really want it because it's compatible with my NES.
The one I always wanted was on the, which I never had, was on the Spectrum, was a surfboard. That sat on the keys, and it was like
really?
This polystyrene, so it was a surfing game, and it sat on the keys in such a way that you put your hand on it and you moved your hand like the body of a surfer.
I have never seen that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're really rare. They do occasionally pop up on eBay. Yeah,
go up this path of possible death.
Creepy looking path.
Yeah, why not? So coming on to I guess this is the first non-generic question. This is the one that actually got me into thinking, what questions could I ask for this? And that's what game shop do you remember the most? And it's a really difficult, because again, people of the latest generation, I mean, my little girl, for example, she'll only know digital gaming,
yep,
Argos, or game just before it's become this non kind of game selling store now. Whereas I grew up with it being Smith's, Boots, Woolworths.
Yeah. I mean, all of those, John Menzies. I used to get games sold quite often. But the one that was a game shop was Electronics Boutique. Was it Electronics Boutique?
You had two. You had Game, and then you had Electronics Boutique.
Now I'm doubting. I think
bought EB.
I'm starting to think that the shop I'm thinking of had got bought out by EB, but it wasn't EB when I used to originally go there.
Right, we're just looking at a path here. That path looks a little bit...
That's dodgy AF.
Yeah, that's going to be one of us ends up on our arse. So let's go left.
Yeah, let's stay level.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think, did EB buy anyone out? Because you did have some big... You had Game Station, you had Electronics Boutique, you had Game. Now,
yep.
Electronics Boutique was around before all of them.
Yep.
They had that kind of white border with the just EB in bright red neons,
yep,
normally.
That's it.
So it was easy to tell where they were, but...
I think it might not have even been a case of sort of EB buying anyone out. It was probably just an independent store that shut.
Right,
and
okay.
And then they took it over. But I only remember it because they always used to have an Amiga in the window with the bouncing ball. And
oh, of course, yeah, the famous 3D demo.
Which I was always sort of slightly in awe of and slightly envious that I didn't have an Amiga. If I'm honest.
I think we all potentially, again, that looks a really steep hill,
just looks
doesn't
like
it?
That drops off to
nowhere. I think let's just loop back round and head back that way. But I think anyone of kind of our era, now I know you're saying you're that bit old, you're not that much old now, but I think everyone had that friend who came to school one day and said, I've got an Amiga.
Yeah.
So, like, are you shitbag?
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, they used to write into me. That was... I didn't have any friends.
I forgot, yes, you upset the Amiga community.
Yes, I did. Oh, dear. But, I mean, where I used to mainly buy games was probably Special Reserve, which was a mail order catalogue. That's where I bought my Mega Drive originally. And I remember ordering off there quite a lot. That catalogue was like a... I don't know. It was the most exciting thing in the world.
Yeah, I'm really glad you bring that sort of world up, because so many people, because of Amazon and the likes of kind of e-shopping now, it's just not known. But the joy of buying something like, one of those, what was it called? Metromask or something like that? The old computer papers you used to get, have pre-built computers, and it was just buy your parts from us, buy your parts from here. And then you'd have the game list, and you'd just have send a stamped addressed envelope to us with a check or a postal order.
That was it, yeah. You sent them a check. You know, I didn't have credit cards or debit cards back in those days, so you'd fill out the form, tell them what you wanted,
and
then wait up to 28 days.
it wasn't
immediate, there was no Amazon Prime or.
And then, of course, if it was a floppy disk game, you had the risk of, has it been treated properly in the post, or does it come with a unreadable?
But it was, it was that. It was, I'm still a bit like it, that excitement of getting something in the post. I don't know.
We've done that loop. I think we came up this bit here. So let's mosey on this way.
Let's see now.
Yes. I don't even know what this is. It's got a road to nowhere.
It's not even that big, and we somehow I've lost my bearings.
it's very, very weird.
This is going to be fun getting down here.
Well, let's walk to the left. Way. This looks a bit more sensible.
That's
but
a bit more gentle.
Okay. So, I think one of the games I remember from kind of that era was one of my best friend at the time. We had a 486 computer at home. We ordered Little Big Adventure.
Oh, yes.
and that came, and that was a CD-ROM, and that was very exciting to just see the post arrive and it being in there. And then, yeah, you got another copy of their catalogue, which was often printed out on an inkjet or an early laserjet.
They knew what they were doing.
Of course.
But, I mean, I suppose with me as well, relatively young, I stopped buying games because I used to get them for free.
Because of your time in Teletext, obviously, you started receiving games and it was a game changer.
Yeah, I mean, it was genuinely... To a 21-year-old, the best job in the world. You know, you would every single day just get a stack of games, sometimes, a month before anyone else. There's no two ways about it. I would have done that for free.
Yeah, of course. Okay, next question then. So I've got here, it's either your worst gaming memory or your biggest letdown moment. The game that you bought, I guess, that you really thought, this is shit. What have I done?
Okay, well, I've got a story about this. And it was Jack and the Beanstalk on the Spectrum.
Oh, okay, that was Gremlin, wasn't it, if I remember right? Same people that did Jack the Nipper and...
Yeah, Jack the Nipper, classic. But Jack and the Beanstalk was so difficult. I mean, I played it again recently, actually, and I got further into it than I ever did as a child. But I was so disappointed because I spent my pocket money on it. I told my dad that it didn't work. And, we went back to the shop to try and exchange it. And, of course, they load it up. And this is really bad, but I tried to demagnetize it with a magnet. And my dad, for some reason, got into a massive argument with the guy in the shop.
Saying that if he says it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Yeah, basically. And I was just standing there cringing. And, they were like, we'll exchange it for another one, but we're not giving you a refund. And anyway, that.
I've got to say, that's a pretty bad one. See, that's similar. So if anyone came to the last Digitize Alive... I took part in the little sideshow that went on, and mine was Monty Mole. And you go and watch it on YouTube because there's lots of horror stories from everyone that was involved in that one.
I haven't watched that yet. Oh, I must.
It was fantastic. I was robbed, personally. I think I was robbed, but...
Was this the 32X Factor?
Yes, that was it. 32X Factor. That changed name throughout it.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, mine was Monty Mole. I think it was Monty Mole on the Run. And... the long and the short of it, I'd got a £5 book token for Boots from a competition at the local constabulary, and popped into Boots, bought that, and it never loaded. And Mum and Dad just said, well, you must be doing something wrong, and that was it.
That's the thing. You see, back then, when you were a kid, you've got such limited money. Every game needs to be good. Otherwise, that's it. You've blown it. And if, you're £2 a month or whatever, or a week, or I think what I used to get.
Well, I've got to say, I don't think I've bought a game in quite a long time now. I think actually the last game I bought was a game called Helldivers 2. Great, great fun, but they've absolutely butchered it. But before that, I haven't bought anything. And because Game Pass exists, and it's the only thing,
Called
PlayStation Plus now as well. That's the only thing that makes it worthwhile having a modern console. If everything's gone digital, I'd rather just play a game until they take it away from me.
I have toyed with signing up for that. It may yet come.
Yeah, it is worth it. I mean, the game that I'm playing at the moment, Rob's introduced me to, called Cult of the Lamb. And it's, in effect, it's a bit like Dungeon Keeper mixed with Animal Crossing on Nintendo.
Right.
So not only do you have to build your little village of all your cult followers, and you've got to keep them happy, and you do your sermons, and you can do rituals.
It's a bit Populous-like. Do you remember Populous?
A bit like Black and White, a bit Populous, a bit Civ. Yeah. But then you also go off and it randomly generates dungeons that you've got to go through, and there's four or five big heretics you've got to defeat at the end of them. Just mind your back, Biffo.
Watch out there.
Okay. Getting near the end then, retro or modern gaming, which are you going to choose? I think we know already by how fondly you've been speaking of retro gaming.
No, you might be surprised. Modern games, far and away. Back in the day, I rarely finished a game because they were so much harder.
Yes.
And they were, So, you know, people moan now about bugs in games and the like. But back then, you know, genuinely games would be released that you couldn't finish.
But that leads to a great argument, which is, were games better back then because people had to make them difficult? They had to think about the game, whereas modern gaming's gone down. How real can we make it look? How real can we make the physics?
I miss the sort of idiosyncrasies of that era that I grew up with. I miss the quirkiness and the sort of authorship. You get that now with, you know, a lot of indie games that come out. And so, you know, I probably do more gaming on my phone than anything else because, you know, I've got Apple Arcade. And,
and Doom's included on that one.
There you go. So, in all honesty, I find gaming a more pleasurable experience now, by and large, with modern games. They were just busted back in the day. You know, and it was just, they were so
I guess it
difficult.
Was easier to ruin your enjoyment of a game back in the day because, like you said with Jack and the Beanstalk, it just being overly hard and there was no option about that. There was no easy, medium, hard. There was no changing the settings on it. Whereas modern gaming, most companies do look at difficulties and say, have it how you want. If you want to play it through on easy, we don't recommend it. It'll be boring, but you can.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things with Star Wars Outlaws. Which, you know, like Star Wars Outlaws is a whole another thing. But the accessibility options on that are insane. You can basically customize everything and have the game more or less as you want it. It's really got to be commended for that. But I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm easily pleased. I love big open world games, big sandbox games. You know, they're like, you know, I'd play games back in the day and I'd imagine what was beyond the walls of the game. Whereas now you don't have to imagine. You can go beyond the walls.
And I guess the first kind of taste I can remember really of that was the first Motocross Madness with Microsoft. And as whether or not you like the game or not, it's always fun just driving a dirt bike around dunes, making you do flips and crashing. And of course, the fact that they introduced this bit that when you got to the furthest point you could, you just got ejected into the air with the sound of a cannon.
Yeah.
It was brilliant, but it was a big world and it was just something you hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
We'll loop back to indie games in one moment because actually there's one thing I want to bring up on there that you've been involved with. But I understand, I could be wrong, you were a big fan of Half-Life 2.
I'd still say it's my favourite game of all time. I still think narratively there hasn't been much to match it in terms of balancing a narrative with gameplay. And I got very emotionally invested in The Last of Us, but it still feels like a game that's trying to be a movie. Was Half-Life 2 for me was a game that knew it was a game and still managed to immerse you in that world through just really smart environmental storytelling. It was dripping with atmosphere and it didn't have to do a lot to sell its story. And, you know, the genius move of giving you a protagonist who doesn't speak, you know, so the player is really embodies.
You become the Gordon Freeman. You are Gordon.
Yeah.
And that's where I think Blue Shift went wrong. So if you go back just one generation of gaming, you got Half-Life 1, which then led on to Opposing Force, which semi-worked because, again, you were a nameless soldier in it. But then you got to Blue Shift even. You're playing Barney, if I remember.
Yeah, you are.
And it's, no, I don't want this.
No. I think it's one of the greatest tragedies in gaming for Valve. Stop making games like it did. I know they did the VR Half-Life.
Oh, VR Alex, yes.
Yeah, but, you know, Portal, again, great storytelling.
For such an odd game as well. It not only was the game fairly short, but in these single room puzzles, you were still getting this story told to you. And then one of the greatest gaming kind of payoffs at the end with the song.
Yeah. I mean, just beautiful. I mean, just, again, without having to sort of over-labour it with cutscenes and...
There aren't any, are there? There really is. You are into each puzzle and then you move on. And I think Half-Life 2, there's a handful of in-game generated scenes, aren't there? Whether it's the G-Man that you come across Professor whatever his name is. But it's Doctor, sorry, isn't it? Not Professor. But it's not over the top. It's enough to keep you invested in the storyline before you progress on. And the difficulty level on it, for me, was ideal.
Perfect.
It was just perfect. The first time I played through it was the original Xbox.
Yep.
So I didn't even get the best way of playing it until several years later when I bought it in the Orange Box bundle.
Right. But it was just, but as well, in addition to the story, it was just the gameplay itself was just so clever with the gravity gun and the physics. And, you know, games have sort of lost that whole thing of kind of building a mechanic around one idea, particularly that sort of game, you know, building it around a mechanic that, you know, completely redefines the gameplay and gives you new things. And that's what Valve did brilliantly with Portal as well, obviously.
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. Now, doubling back to indie games then, very quickly, I understand, and a huge big up to a game called Quantum Witch, which I think is in wish list at the moment. It will be released when it's released, but Nikki's game, which you've been involved in, and it's amazing.
Yeah, well, she, you know, she wanted some help with the story, and, you know, it's still her story and her idea. I just helped to structure it, I guess, narratively speaking, and just try to kind of, I mean, I love doing it, you know, kind of thinking about story, but in terms of gameplay. So again, it's that Half-Life thing of never sort of taking too much control out of the player's hands, so that the player always feels immersed in that world. But, you know, we hit upon this idea of, you know, how do we kind of break the fourth wall in a way that hasn't been done?
And, yeah.
You know, do we, I don't want to give away spoilers, actually, just in case anyone plays it. But we did some really interesting stuff with the story, and it's funny and, you know, but it's very much Nikki's baby.
Yeah, and I should say, really, for those of you that are interested, go and look it up. But the bonus of indie games, which I guess modern game developers don't necessarily think about too much, because, again, they're stuck with the idea of it has to look real now, is this is very much back in the 16-bit era graphics. It's a side-scrolling game. It's reminiscent of the, if anyone knows, of something like Flashback or Another World.
Yeah, I guess. And it's a bit, you know, with elements of sort of point and click in there.
And then, yeah, the point and click part of it as well. So it's beautiful pixel art.
Yeah, well, all done by Nikki. Great music by Jordan Cook. And, you know, it's got some big ideas in there, which I think is what really makes it interesting. And they all come from Nikki, really. You know, she had some big themes that she wanted to explore.
And she is the heart and soul of the game. So absolutely. It's if you're looking for anything new, go and stick it on your wish list if it's not already. I believe the demo version's out as well, so you get to see the first part of the story. Go and find it now. I'll stick links below in the metadata of this. And then the final question, which is just in time for us as we're getting back to the car park, is your Desert Island disc, really? Really, really generic question.
Well, I would have said Half-Life 2.
But that works. It's so replayable.
Yeah.
Even though it is on a rail, you are always going to be following the same route.
I've played it more than any other game. I've completed it more than any other game. You know, there's so few games that I play over and over once I've gotten to the end.
But you still get the excitement of it. I played through it recently. The regular gunships that turn up launching into you, or the swamp boat sort of section where you, brilliant puzzle bits of game that you've got to just take a little break from, because you're going to go and do a little walk around, find something, do a switch, but then you're just thrown straight back in. And I fully agree with you on that one. I can see that.
It's so immersive, you know, in ways that so many open world games don't always manage. Sometimes they do, but yeah, it's just endlessly replayable for me.
No, I'm not going to say anything about it, because I think it's a bloody good choice. So we're back at the cars pretty much. So if you can off your cuff, otherwise I'll just stick it all in the metadata, where can people find you? What is the things that you want to advertise for yourself at the moment?
Oh, lordy. well, the
sell YouTube, yourself.
The YouTube channel, which in the last year has undergone a little bit of a change, but you know, it's still got its heart and soul, which is still tongue-in-cheek a lot of the time, but we developed a bit of a social conscience. I think I'm getting older. So digitise that on YouTube, go find it.
Fantastic. And then, yeah, social media-wise, you can find Paul, aka Mr. Biffo, on the majority of the platforms now, but I think you're still more, like most of us, our following started on Twitter, so it's kind of hard to let go of it as much of a fucking mess as it is.
Yeah, I mean, I mainly use Patreon now for kind of communicating with people. So, you know, I do post on there for free sometimes as well. We do have free.
No, and of course, if you do enjoy Mr. Biffo stuff, the digitized stuff, then please do go and look at the Patreon, because as many creators are not always willing to share as much as they should do, creating on a regular basis is not a cheap thing to do. It's certainly not something you can do free and make a living out of. So if you do run into a Patreon for a creator that you like, please do go and seek it out. Even if it's just to do the minimum amount a month, it all helps.
Yes, I will concur with that statement.
Well, in that case then, I will try and do another Retro Rambles at some point soon. Paul, thank you very much for our little walk.
You're welcome, Tom.
And join us next time. We'll be around next week for the normal episode.
Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
This was a Studio Channel 84 network show. To find more, head over to channel84.co.uk now.